FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is August 29th, 2018. Well, trade wars with China, we've had trade wars all over the place, and yet Trump, as always, is victorious. Let's see what will happen with Canada, China, and others. So far, agreement with Mexico, agreement with the EU. And as always, be part of the conversation. Make my day. Send me an email to kl@kerrylutz.com with anything you want to share. So, trade war, is it real? Is it PR? Is there more to it than meets the eye? Daniel Joseph, Dan, you're back with us, an expert in China trade, and you have an interesting perspective on what exactly is going on. So first, as always, welcome back, and it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Hey, so trade war, is it really a trade war? I mean, I question this because the media always misperceives exactly what's going on. They really provide no useful insights, the mainstream media, and I don't think they really understand what they're talking about anyway.
Yeah, well, I think the media in general, they like to play the hype. They like to play the sizzle and not the fact. And the fact of the matter is the trade war, you know, thus far has been more threats than anything else. Now, there are some actual tariffs out there. I mean, the steel and aluminum tariffs are real. And we have implemented some tariffs against the Chinese, you know, a relatively small percentage of the overall trade. And they have counteracted that. But the really serious issues would be, for example, if we went forward with some of the stuff that's been discussed on automobiles. But we've actually put that on the back burner now. So that's been held off. We've announced another round of tariffs against China that could hit $200 billion of their products. That could get pretty serious and could start showing up in the prices of certain more commonly purchased products. So if we get to that point, we'll start to say, well, this might have a serious economic impact. Right now, the overall economic impact is not huge. And Trump has been basically moving his agenda forward, attempting to, the agreements and whatnot, with more threats, actions, small actions, bigger threats, and then let's talk it through. And so far, obviously, nothing's blown up, and we've got some good progress on agreements. So it's so far, the strategy's working.
So far, Trump has been successful. And hey, let's face it, the $500 billion trade deficit with China, they probably have a lot more to lose than the U.S., but we're talking about other issues. We're talking about intellectual property theft. It's been a big issue of Trump's from the get-go. We're talking about just the, you know, one thing China was doing, the deficit's even larger, is transshipping through China, through Mexico and Canada, and use auto parts and such. So they're definitely going to take a hit there with Mexico, because that the local content rule there is going up to 75% over a period of time. It's being worked out, and we just have to see what the response is going to be here.
Yeah, I think that so far we don't really have an idea what the bottom line is that Trump might have relative to China. I mean, at the end of the day, this is really going to be more about how China manages its economy and opening up its markets. I don't think, looking broadly at everything we import from China, you know, a lot of it is consumer products or high labor content, low value added stuff that is not going to be in our interest to, you know, place a high tariff on, because it's going to raise our prices here. And that production is likely to move to Vietnam or Bangladesh or somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So Trump has resisted the idea of just, boom, here's a tariff with nothing. He's using the tariff to try to negotiate what he sees as the real issues. And I think that's the right approach to go to. So the question, some of that becomes very complicated. Like you said, intellectual property, state subsidies. What it really comes down to is, here's the bottom line for your listeners. We've had something of a one-sided relationship with China, but that's because, number one, they were a low-cost country. I mean, when you don't have a lot of money, A, you can't buy stuff, B, you sell cheap stuff. Secondly, all countries, poor countries, are protectionists. And China has actually become a lot less protectionist than, say, India or Russia or Brazil. And that's why they've grown. But we have let them, in terms of their own reform of their domestic market, lag a little bit. When China was poor and they weren't a big market and they weren't a competitor, that didn't matter much. But over the last 10 or 15 years, as they've slowed their domestic reforms down and they've become a more important market, for example, the largest automobile market in the world, and they've become a potential customer or competitor simply because they have so much savings they can invest in whatever industry they want, and they have a population five times our size, the rules that were appropriate when you were only a low-cost supplier and the rules that were appropriate when you're now a large market and a potential competitor are different. And China's the way it manages its economy, it needs to catch up with that reality. Otherwise, you end up with situations where China might be out there attempting to acquire U.S., German, Canadian companies in a key industry so that they can acquire technology, while at the same time saying, you can't compete in that industry in our country, which is obviously patently unfair. So the key here is we need reciprocal fairness. If they want access to our markets, we need to have the same access to theirs. I think that's going to be the main focus of the conversations once we kind of dial up the pressure on China.
Yeah, inclined to agree. And the fact is that China has not been confronted by the U.S. really ever. Maybe going back to Vietnam was the last time we bothered to confront them. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's all different. Everything has changed, and Trump is confronting them on economic, political, and militarily. And they're pushing back a bit, but they don't know exactly how to handle Trump. If you read the discussions about him in Asia, they don't view him quite the way half the American public does, that he's a buffoon, a dummy, a rash actor, that he doesn't think things out. Dishonest, whatever. They view him as a master strategist, which should be a wake-up call for the left, but they won't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Trump, I like to say that, you don't become a superpower overnight. There's a lot of lessons that China has to learn. Part of the problem with the current debate over China, not that this delegitimizes any of the concerns we have, but in the course of these conversations, we have a tendency, people who think we need to address China sometimes have a tendency to portray China as if they do nothing wrong. They're expanding. They're going to control the world. The fact is, they have plenty of problems with their domestic economy. Their One Belt, One Road initiative, I mean, their can't projects are being canceled all over the place because no one can pay for it. To you and me, looking at this, to the Chinese, this is wonderful. We've arrived. We're going to spread billions of dollars. Hey, we're from America. We've seen this before. We tried to put money into Latin America. Did that help? They don't listen to what we say. They don't care. And now that's what's China, guns and butter diplomacy. You end up having people that, frankly, don't have the means owing you a lot of money. And in the short term, all you've done is create projects for your construction firm. So the One Belt, One Road initiative isn't going very well. There are efforts to invest in energy projects all over the world. They've lost tons of money. So China is trying to grow into being a superpower. Now, one of the issues I think they have, and they're trying to figure this out, is, everybody wants to point the attention at Trump. And certainly Donald Trump has that type of personality. But I always like to point out to people, the second strongest protectionist message in the last election was Bernie Sanders, a Democrat. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Hillary Clinton wasn't far behind. Politicians like this are hitting this note because America is in that frame of mind. So Trump might be a bit of a wild card. We can all admit that he's different, but he's not standing there alone. So that's why, you made the point. I do think to a certain extent they might be waiting until after the midterms to see how, just what kind of strength Trump has. But what they need to understand is he's not standing alone on this. Some of his tactics, yes. But overall, he's got fairly broad support. And he's also got some opposition. I'm not saying he doesn't. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, the Chinese do see him as a shrewd negotiator. They're hoping he'll become isolated. And I think they might end up being disappointed on that.
Yeah. And he's shown that they don't really know what to expect from him. I think all of the other presidents going way, way back all had were very predictable in many ways. We could go back pre-World War II, but post-World War II, they all kind of fed from the same trough, and they really kind of just acted the same. Policies were continuations, regardless what the party. And then we get Trump, and it's a brave new world. And China, U.S. is still their most important single market. Yes, the EU combined is a larger market, but it's not a homogenous market necessarily. U.S. homogenous market, and 20% or so of China's economy revolves around the U.S. directly or indirectly. So they've got a lot of uncertainties ahead of them, and like you said, their effort to colonize Africa has kind of been a failure. Yeah, they got a lot of mining interests there, a lot of natural resources, but these countries are fed up with them because they would make deals with China, not for trade, but to come in and develop a project, a mine someplace in Eritrea or whatever. And China would say, well, we just need the ability to ship in equipment, whatever, computers for the project, but then they would flood the local market with equipment that really had nothing to do with the project, and thereby really screw up the economy of that African nation. And as a result, the Africans are like begging the U.S. to come back, a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, infrastructure projects in poor countries, I'm sorry, it's 80 years old, and it's hard to do. And they love you when the money's coming in. And then when it's time to pay you back, they couldn't care less. And their own domestic politics is what ends up, mashing everything up, right? In Malaysia right now, the new prime minister, who's a guy who was in office 20 years ago, he's going to end up canceling. Yeah. $20+ billion in projects, and he's just going to blame it on the other guy. Got a bad deal for Malaysia. Well, he doesn't want the debt. He doesn't like the projects. In some projects, the Chinese might bring in too many of their own too many Chinese people to work on the project. In others, they maybe they're not making that mistake, maybe not offending the locals for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's still a very difficult situation to manage, and they're finding more disappointment than success, which frankly isn't a surprise to anyone who studies this type of thing. So yeah, it's hard to be a superpower. They've got a lot to learn, and we might have, although I agree that we have some important issues on our trade agenda, we don't necessarily have to portray them as this unstoppable force that's going to overwhelm the world. They're going to, and by the way, let's keep this in mind. China has friendly relations, like very close relations, with virtually none of its immediate neighbors. Not the Russians, not the Koreans, not the Vietnamese, not the Indians. They have a border dispute. So it's going to be tough for them to build the kind of alliances to get the kind of support they have. On the other hand, and I'm not saying they're despised. People like to have capital invested in their country, by the way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if Trump one of the great misnomers of this whole debate is when Trump started to be a little bit isolationist, people were saying that the Europeans and others are going to align with China. That's so impossible. Their interests are too different. And by the way, the Germans and the Brits and the French, they have the same issues with China that we do. So that was never going to happen. But China wasn't going to replace us as the fulcrum in this whole thing. And now that Trump is actually unifying Europe and the others in a unified approach against China, that's going to make it even more difficult to resist some of the demands that will be made.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. Hey, they built this huge casino project in Nassau, Bahamas, and the Chinese were basically bankrolling it. They sent in all their own workers, not a lot of not a lot of Bahamian workers were really right there. It went bankrupt. Now China owns it. The Chengyuang family. It's really an amazing thing. I watched them building it. They had a man camp of 5,000 Chinese workers there, overwhelming the island. And you know, this thing is a loser. And I said from the get-go that what they were doing here, this is a way to get money out of China. It's much better to have a losing entity outside of China that you have to keep sending money to subsidize, because nobody really can know what your losses are. It's easier to figure out the profits than the losses. And this is exactly what the thing has turned into, a big money pit for Chinese money to get out of China. It's really quite funny the way it worked out. I knew it was going to go bankrupt. I knew they would never get big Chinese whales to an island resort in the Bahamas to go lose money. Just couldn't be. And here it is. Boom. It's dead. I think it opened. I kind of haven't gotten around to going there yet just to check it out. It's not really in a desirable area, not like Paradise Island, but this whole thing just turned into a blunder for them.
Yeah. I mean, you've hit on a couple of good points with that example. First of all, you know, all less developed countries have high corruption problems, weakness in the rule of law. China will take many more decades to claw its way out of there. The only thing that really solves that is a successful market-based economy. So, and this is a little insight into how China works. I mean, they have tens of billions of dollars that seep out of that country illegally every year, usually through the state-owned banks that control they're dominant in the banking system. So here you have these institutions owned by the government and yet used, you pay off the right state-owned banking official and you can get your money out for any purposes. And they try to tighten their capital control sometimes, but there's always a way to do it. Now, you just mentioned a very interesting one. Yeah, investing in a legitimate project overseas where you can squirrel away some money is sometimes a good idea, but that hits on what is a crucial aspect of the upcoming negotiations. As everyone says, the Chinese don't vote. So there's this sense that there's less political pressure on the president, Xi Jinping. But I always like to point this out. If there's no pressure on you, why would you increase the debt in China by such a drastic amount? Why would you be so desperate to keep people employed and to keep economic growth going that you would ruin your national balance sheet? And the answer is that, yes, people can't vote politically, but people vote economically. And Xi Jinping, like every other Chinese president over the last 40 years, knows that the legitimacy of the party as well as social stability depends on continued economic success. And he's done whatever it takes to maintain that. He's just running out of room to continue his debt. And the way people vote in an economy is mostly with capital. When consumers stop spending, which we're starting to see, and then when capital starts to flee that country, if the economy keeps slowing down, Europe, the United States, Japan all unite forces and kind of turn the screws and say, listen, we need to see some changes, but China resists. If sentiment on the Chinese economy just gradually gets worse, you're going to see capital trying to get out of that country. And then we're going to see we could potentially see the kind of real economic slowdown even further that we haven't seen in China for years. And it will be interesting to see if Xi Jinping decides the way to deal with that is just a political clampdown or to do the smarter thing, which is to cut a deal that makes sense, bring more competition, more economic freedom to China, which is what they need anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So I couldn't agree with you more. We've got all of these things happening and very few people really understand it. And this is where the media is so completely and utterly useless when it comes to this. They're really just not helpful at all. And hey, we're just going to have to see what happens next here. But people want to find out more about what you're doing there and check out your writings on the web. Dan, where's the best place to find your stuff?
My website is China learningcurve.com. That's the name of my firm. We do a lot of training and consulting relative to China. So it's ChinaLearningCurve.com, and that's where all my blog posts are. You can find us on LinkedIn as well if you searched on that, but and Twitter and whatnot. But and on Twitter, I'm at the Real China Guy, and all my blogs are posted there as well. So, you know, just like you said, I mean, the media has a hard time handling Trump on the one side, and then on the other side, China tends to be complex. There's so many different interpretations of China, even by people who are well-meaning, that everything has a tendency to get muddled. To me, it's amazing that the same people who predicted the eternal rise of Japan via industrial policy are now saying that China is doing the same thing, and they don't seem to be dissuaded by the fact that they turned out to be wrong about Japan, which somehow
totally wrong
their opinion. I mean, Japan was supposed to go through the roof because their government called all the shots and guided investment. It turns out that only works to a certain point. Then it turns out the government makes bad investments, and if you don't continue liberalizing your domestic economy, just doing exports doesn't work. And of course, Japan's debt to GDP is above 400% now, and that's a smart country, good people, innovative, and the government's just screwed the whole thing up with this debt binge. And if China's not careful, they're going to do the same darn thing. So, I mean, what China needs to do is get off that path and do what Trump wants them to do, which they should be doing without Trump's pressure, frankly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And eventually, I think they're going to – one thing, you know, we didn't talk about and – mistake, so let's just cover this real fast. So the Chinese impose reciprocal tariffs, and what do they impose them on but soybeans? And they box themselves into a corner because, quite simply, there aren't enough soybeans in the open market to replace the lost American production or imports that will result from the tariff. So pretty much they have to buy American no matter what. They're not happy about it. So it's screwed up the market short term. But in the long term, unless they want to stop animal production, which is the primary use of soybeans and soybean meal, feeding stock animals like pigs and cattle, they're going to have to come back to the U.S. So it just shows that they're rattled by Trump. He got them out of their comfort zone, and they acted rashly. And they made a big mistake.
Yeah, I mean, look, as you and I have discussed before, I'm a believer that, you know, free trade works. And a lot of people that support Trump's agenda agree with that. They just don't think we have trade that's fair enough. So I'm on board with that. Let's get fairer trade. But the point is, interconnected supply chains, capacity issues, all of these things make it difficult to predict. You know, it's like socialized medicine. Just because you set a price here doesn't mean you understand supply and demand, and what you end up doing is throwing the market out of whack. Tariffs can do the same thing. We could make similar miscalculations thinking, well, if we put a tariff on this, what people aren't buying from China, that'll be good for us. Well, maybe the production shifts to Vietnam. That can happen too. And then what are we going to do? Then we put tariffs on Vietnam too, and it gets very complicated. And what the Chinese did is exactly what you described. Everybody was saying, well, the Chinese are just going to, you know, retaliate on soybeans, and our farmers are going to be up a creek. Well, maybe it's not going to work out that way, because maybe Brazil doesn't have the capacity to make everybody happy. So you have this sense now that, wait a minute, China might have shot themselves in the foot on soybeans. So no matter which side you're on, it's going to be hard to fight your way through this. The immediate pain is China's, because they have more exports. But they have, you know, something like 44% of the S&P 500's revenue comes overseas, obviously not all from China. China could step on Apple, step on GM and Ford in ways that could hurt us. I mean, we wouldn't be without pain. But at the end of the day, if you're gonna place an economic bet, the bet you would place right now is, as I said before, some people want to give the political advantage to China. I'm not sure they get that. But what they don't have right now is the economic momentum advantage. We have that.
Yes.
Because of the way they've mismanaged their economy
for
10 years. So pain will be spread around. Mm-hmm. But the idea that China can manage it better than the United States, which a lot of people went into this thinking, I never thought that was the case, that they are subject to economic pressure more so than people think just because they don't have political elections. Don't let that fool you. There's still pressure over there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because in fact, there can be more pressure because they're not, they don't have that safety valve, the speaker's corner in Hyde Park, which probably the UK will outlaw the way they're going shortly, but we still have it here in the US, is a pressure release valve. If it's working right now, we could debate that. Dan, it's always great to talk to you. Hey, any questions or comments? We just invite you to join the discussion. KL@KerryLutz is the email address. So please send, make my day. Then we've got a Twitter feed @KerryLutz and the Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. Dan, we'll talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much for checking in.
Thanks for having me, Kerry. It was a pleasure as always.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to FinancialSurvivalNetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.